Hello and welcome to our program, The Advocates. My name is Richard J. Garfunkel. I'm the host of this weekly forum. This program is coming from Jupiter, Florida, in the studios of WJUP 103.9 FM, Sunday morning,
March 27th, 2016.
One can also hear this program live streaming. My guest this morning is author Susan Butler, and our subject is Roosevelt and Stalin, their partnership that won the war and, unfortunately, the lost peace. As I say each week, the mission of The Advocates is to bring to the public different views on current public policy issues. Public policy, therefore, is what we as a nation legally and traditionally follow. Welcome, Susan Butler, to The Advocates, and thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for asking me.
Yeah, my pleasure. Meanwhile, my guest Susan Butler was a freelance writer whose work regularly appeared in the New York Times and Barron's. Her interest in journalism dates back to her college years at Bennington, where she was the editor of the newspaper. She later went on to Columbia University, where she earned a master's degree from the School of Arts and Sciences. She now lives in Florida. Her first book, East to Dawn, was a biography of Amelia Earhart. Butler became interested in Amelia Earhart because she was a courageous, glamorous, and individual and had achieved fame and fortune by the virtue of her own talents. It became a successful bestseller, published in 1997. The Washington Post called it the single best book that we now have on Earhart's life. The book was also the basis of a movie about her, starring Hilary Swank and Richard Gere. She is the author of My Dear Mr. Stalin, The Complete Correspondence of Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Joseph Stalin. Her book, Roosevelt and Stalin, which I have right here, Portrait of a Partnership, published in last March, is the first book that solely, fully explores probably the most complex partnership during World War II between these two giants of that era, FDR and Stalin. Most historians who are interested in this period of history and folks of a certain age remember the big three of World War II and think of Winston Churchill as America's great wartime partner. They know of his inspiring speeches, his meeting with FDR in Argentia Bay and the co-authoring of the Atlantic Charter, his special relationship with Roosevelt and our partnership in prosecuting the war against Nazi Germany in North Africa, Sicily, Italy, Northern Europe, of course, France. But they know little of Stalin, the effort of the Soviet Union, Eastern Europe, and their immense contribution to the final victory. Susan, tell us about Joseph Stalin and the connection between the United States and the Soviet Union that preceded World War II.
Well, before Roosevelt, there was no connection between the Soviet Union and the United States. Lenin had tried from the first days he was in power to make America his ally in an otherwise hostile world. But it wasn't until FDR in 1933 recognized the Soviet Union that there was any relationship. Even though Lenin, in 1919, had written, "Entering into a relationship with the United States is the issue of paramount importance. The fate of the Soviet Union depends on its successful resolution." So when Roosevelt finally recognized the Soviet Union in 1933, it was sort of pretty much like our recognition of Cuba, which just took place, which just, of course, has galvanized the Cuban people.
Yes.
The Russians were thrilled.
You know, in the days leading up to World War II, there were many events that foreshadowed the potential of another European war. The German reoccupation of the Rhineland, the absorption of Austria into Germany, the seizure of the Sudetenland, and the eventual occupation of Czechoslovakia were all elements that led to both appeasement by the British and the French and fear of more aggressiveness from Nazi Germany. Susan, tell us about the meaning and the consequence of the Ribbentrop-Molotov Pact that was signed in the late summer of 1939.
Well, Roosevelt had tried to push Foreign Secretary Lord Halifax and Prime Minister Chamberlain, who, of course, Chamberlain had signed the Munich Agreement. He tried to push them into making a mutual alliance treaty with Stalin, which Stalin very much wanted. But England and France, England was really acting for France. They were allies, England and France. England was more afraid of communism than they were of Hitler. And so they refused. They just sort of strung Litvinov, who was the ambassador, the Soviet ambassador, they strung him along, and finally Stalin simply gave up on trying to make a treaty with England because it was obviously not going to happen. And the only reason that England was actually talking to him was because Roosevelt was pushing them. And so finally, in an effort to forestall Hitler from invading the Soviet Union, he made a treaty with Hitler, hoping that it would at least gain him time.
Right. Now, would you say that the reticence of the British as the senior partner between the British and the French had the troops, they had the Maginot Line, they were, felt comfortable sitting behind it. Do you think that the consequences of British appeasement came out of almost a mutual fear of the Nazis and the communists? In a sense, would you say that there were many in Britain who would have liked to seen both of these totalitarian superpowers struggle against each other?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I think that Churchill and Halifax would have been thrilled. Well, of course, Churchill was later, but I think Halifax and Chamberlain would have been absolutely thrilled, and Churchill later, if they had gone at each other's throats.
You know, Poland became the tripwire for this war. Was there any reason why England or France had any particular affection for Poland, any kind of long-term association? In other words, this treaty, this agreement over the sanctity of the Polish border, what was it? Was this really sort of disingenuous, or was this a tripwire to prevent Hitler's Germany from gobbling up another country?
You know, I've never understood why. I think that England simply was using Poland as the excuse because there was no real relationship between them. And in fact, the Polish foreign minister, whose last name was Beck, Josef Beck, was actually a friend of Hitler's and trusted Hitler. Mm. He was pro-German.
And also, as we later learn, most of Eastern Europe, they weren't democracies in Bulgaria or Hungary or Poland. They weren't really democratic states. They were really authoritative states. Wouldn't you agree with that?
Well, they were more than authoritarian states. Actually, they were ruled by the landed gentry, it was more a world of the landed gentry and the peasants.
Right. So, in a sense, the class structure that we innately see in England, of course, there wasn't really a class structure in Eastern Europe. It was the one percenters and everyone else. In fact, there was hardly a middle class except for the people who served it. So, in a sense, Poland is this tripwire that the West, certainly France and Britain, allies of the First World War, are saying to themselves, we're going to sign a treaty with these people, and if that frontier is violated, that's where the buck stops. So as a consequence of that pact, World War II started with a German and Soviet invasion of Poland. How did the Soviets rationalize their participation in the partitioning of Poland?
Well, there were two things. In the first place, Poland is the land that Germany had to cross to invade Russia, which they had done in World War I. And historically, Poland and Russia had been at war and at each other's throats for generations. Mm. There are two, actually, structures in Red Square. One, of course, we all know about it. It's Lenin's tomb. But the other one is a statue of two Russian heroes. They're the two Russian heroes who flew the Poles out of the Kremlin in 1612. Mm. Russia and Poland had been, I should say, at each other's throats for generations.
Mm. In fact, people say almost 500 years. And in a sense, there was no love loss between them. But in other words, the Soviets, in a sense, I gather through your writings and others that the Soviets said to themselves, if we don't partition Poland, the Germans are going to be right on our border. And therefore, one could look at this as a defensive act. What was the reaction of the... Yeah, go ahead.
That's the way that Hull and Roosevelt were looking at it, that they had to do that as part of the treaty with Hitler, and that it was probably a smart thing to do because it would help to protect them when and if Hitler attacked.
Now, what was the reaction, again, in the United States and Britain, first with the public, privately, the leadership? How did Britain see this these actions by the Soviets?
Well, I think they were basically entirely misunderstood when the Ribbentrop Pact was announced, for instance, in this country. I think people thought that it was an act of war by Russia. They didn't understand, I mean, except, of course, for the State Department and Roosevelt. I think most people thought it was an act of war on the part of the Soviet Union.
Mm. And how about,
Excuse me.
Go ahead.
Whitaker Chambers, for instance, was totally aghast, and that was one of the reasons that he always gave for resigning from the Communist Party, because he was so shocked and he thought it was a betrayal on the part of Stalin.
Yeah, well, to bring the our public up to date, there was a tremendous amount of animosity, obviously, between the forces of the Soviet Union and the fascist forces, especially Nazi Germany and fascist Italy. And a lot of this animosity had taken part in a hot war in Spain. How did both of these sides, in other words, the concept of a non-aggression pact, especially after this long, bloody war in Spain, seem pretty hard for people to digest? Would you agree with that?
Yes. No, I do agree. I absolutely agree with you, Richard.
So, in other words, basically what we're seeing in the late 1930s is two systems, a status system in Germany and Italy, a kind of combination of a totalitarian government to keep the streets clean, end the influence of the unions, very much of what we know about what proceeded in Nazi Germany. And on the other hand, the Soviet Union was also a totalitarian state in a lot different shape. Through the 30s in France, especially with the Leon Blum and the Popular Front and many other countries, there was always this struggle between the left and the right. And so, in other words, the public in both England and France must have been incredibly confused by this this non-aggression pact.
I think that's true, but I also think it's true that many people in the United States were also, not just England and France, were also confused by it. I mean, when Hitler finally did invade the Soviet Union in June of 1941, even Harry Truman, who was then senator from Missouri, said he thought that we should let the two countries fight each other to the death.
Yeah, well, there was a tremendous feeling of that they wanted these two regimes to indulge in bloodletting, weaken themselves. I think this is sort of a kind of mythological thinking, in a sense. And of course, I do believe that you know, and we're not trying to analyze, you know, the psychology of Stalin, of course, or, you know, justify his existence. We'll get into more about his personality later. But in a sense, it seems that the public's understanding of the needs of the Soviet people hundreds of years after hundreds of years of czarist rule, after a devastating First World War, invasions, poverty, all sorts of intrigue that goes on. I think, as opposed to today, people had absolutely no concept of what existed in Eastern Europe in those days, and probably weren't that concerned. Would you say that?
Well, I think there were many people in the United States that actually did know something about communism, but communism in the 1930s and 1940s was legal in the United States. I mean, you could be a communist and declare yourself in America and not be put in jail. There was no danger. There were no laws against being a communist. But there were people who were very fearful that their country would go communist. Europe was very afraid of that. In America, I think that our government, certainly particularly Roosevelt, felt that in a vibrant, successful society, there was no danger that communism could possibly endanger our government. Or be accepted by our citizens.
Yeah, and of course we had candidates of the socialist left, Eugene V. Debs and Norman Thomas. We actually had socialists in the House of Representatives. We had the Farm Labor Party in Minnesota. We had many people on what we consider the far left, and people didn't lose their lunch over it. You know, before we hear a word from our sponsors, this is The Advocates with Richard J. Garfunkel on WJUP 103.9 FM radio in Jupiter, Florida.
March 27th, 2016.
Sunday mornings at 8 a.m. this show starts. I have been talking to my guest author, Susan Butler. We've been discussing the relationship that would emerge post the Russian and German invasion of Poland, and the events that led up to this alliance of the greatest war in history. We'll be back in a few seconds and discuss more about this interesting subject. Welcome back to The Advocates with Richard J. Garfunkel on WJUP 103.9 FM radio in Jupiter, Florida, on Sunday morning. I've been talking to my guest, author Susan Butler, and we've been discussing Roosevelt, the leadership of the of America, and Stalin, and their relationship and partnership that would eventually win World War II. You know, the violence of World War II escalated dramatically in 1941, with both the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, which brought the Americans into the war, and the massive German invasion of the Soviet Union. With the German invasion, Susan, how did Stalin react, especially with all the warnings sent to him by Britain, the United States, his super spy in Japan, Richard Sorg, and his own sources? How did he deal with this shock?
Well, he was totally into denial. His generals had been watching, of course, the border, the Polish border. And they had noticed that there were incursions of German planes. There was a great deal of activity. There were tanks that were drawing near the border, and they kept a couple of them, the ones that were totally afraid of Stalin, kept bringing these things to his attention. And of course, there was Richard Sorge, who actually had announced the day that the invasion was going to take place. Roosevelt and Churchill, through their intelligence intercepts, were also very aware and signaled to Stalin to watch out because the Germans were ready to invade. And Stalin refused to believe it. He just absolutely was like a man or like an ostrich putting his head in the sand. He kept saying, no, 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 it's not going to happen. When it finally did happen, For the first couple of hours, he refused to allow his troops to retaliate or to even almost defend themselves. And he, then when he realized that in fact he was wrong, that Hitler was invading with a massive amount of troops and planes and tanks and soldiers, he retired to his dacha and collapsed. Basically, had a nervous breakdown, and he was in a state of shock and ceased to function for over a week. And his staff had to cover for him, and it was an incredibly dangerous time for the Russian people.
Mm. Could he have been overthrown at that period of time, and did he expect it even?
He did. He thought he had failed Lenin, and that he'd lost his country, and any one of his men could have actually knocked him off. But instead, they waited for him to recover. So, in a sense, his personality had triumphed because they respected him and they waited for him to pull himself back together.
Yeah. You know, with America now in the war, both the Pacific and European theaters, FDR and Churchill created the machinery for both their military staffs, headed by Generals George Marshall and Alan Brooke, to explore unified strategy and tactics. How did they both see Stalin and the Soviet Union, and who took the leadership role in recognizing the importance of the Soviets with regards to a potential Allied victory?
Well, I think Roosevelt did. Roosevelt and Churchill had very different views of Stalin. Churchill, of course, realized that he needed to be friendly with Stalin, but he was expecting just for the war years. He didn't trust him at all.
Right.
Whereas Roosevelt was a man who had a great understanding of people, and whereas Churchill compared Stalin to a crocodile, and thought he was just as wild and irrational. Roosevelt treated him as if he was a rational person, and a person who could be dealt with, because he expected that Stalin would always put his country's best interests forward, which of course he did.
Yeah, in a sense, it was understood by both FDR and Churchill that the Soviet Union had to survive both their great losses, the sieges of Stalingrad, Moscow, and Leningrad. They had to survive to be this partnership because, of course, their great fear, and we may talk about that later, was the fact that Russia would not have a two front. In other words, as long as the Soviet Union could hold off Nazi Germany, it would give time for the Allies to almost peck at the edges and build up their forces.
I mean, it wasn't even a matter of giving them time. It was a matter that if Russia had been defeated, then Hitler would have not only have gained all that territory, but they would have gained all the oil that Russia had. If Hitler had defeated the Soviet Union, he probably would have been unstoppable, and Britain would have been next.
Yeah, that's very true, of course, and you bring up the very critical element of the oil in Baku and the Caucasus, and you know, a modern army, you know, Napoleon said an army marches on its stomach, but in a modern army, it rolls on its wheels, etc. How did Lend-Lease help the Soviet Union? How important was it to keep them in the war?
Lend-Lease was crucial, absolutely crucial. If it hadn't been for Lend-Lease, I think actually Stalin said it would have made the difference. Stalin said that if it hadn't been for Lend-Lease, Russia would have been defeated.
How did Lend-Lease come about? What was it? Was it easy for America to achieve that politically, legislatively? What were the forces behind Lend-Lease that...
Forces behind Lend-Lease would really come down to one man, and that one man was Franklin Roosevelt. And he likened it to, if your neighbor's house is on fire, you'll give him a hose to put out the fire. And he couched it in such language that even that Congress accepted it.
Mm.
When they were first thinking of England and that we were going to be helping England. But after Operation Barbarossa, the invasion of Russia, Roosevelt extended Lend-Lease to Russia and Congress agreed to it.
Mm.
But Stalin was very free in his and very vocal in his praise. At one point he said, which was quoted in all the U.S. papers, the most important things in this war are the machines. The United States is a country of machines. Mm. Without the use of these machines through Lend-Lease, we would lose this war.
Yeah. And, of course, Lend-Lease... Yeah, go ahead.
We gave thousands of trucks, jeeps. We gave 15,000 amputation saws. We gave them the cloth so that they could make coats for their soldiers. We fed them. I saw one figure where half a pound a day of food for each Russian soldier came from the United States.
Mm. And of course, this was in direct opposition to the American neutrality laws, were...
No. The neutrality laws were finally repealed.
Oh, no, I know. This was directly opposite to what we had in the neutrality laws. And, of course, so the public knows that this stuff didn't get all the way to Russia magically. The northern routes to Murmansk and Archangel were very, very dangerous, very fraught with problems, submarines, air attacks, etc., etc. And our merchant marine actually proved to be one of the great assets to helping not only feed Russia but arm Russia through Lend-Lease. In the last minute or so before our next break, tell us a little bit about how FDR was able to facilitate the Lend-Lease and get it going without the obvious red tape that we always hear about.
Well, he basically put Harry Hopkins in charge of it, and then Harry Hopkins efficient people. Basically, I suppose the most important was Edward R. Stettinius, in charge of pushing Lend-Lease through and getting all of the armaments and all of the planes on ships. But he had a great deal of trouble because it's very hard to move a nation and convert factories, which is what Roosevelt was insisting on, converting factories from producing automobiles to producing planes to producing guns. But Roosevelt was very adept and got things moving pretty fast.
Yeah. Well, there's no doubt that Harry Hopkins was the unsung hero of that effort. Maybe to this generation his name is forgotten, but to people who understand history, they look at him as a remarkable public servant, certainly on the domestic area in the New Deal and in World War II. Churchill really admired him, called him Mr. Root of the Matter. He got right down to the points, and he was not a well man. He was a man who fought tremendous physical ailments that eventually would kill him within a year after the war. But he really was one of our great heroes of that era that, you know, we don't always hear about. You know, before we hear a word from our sponsors, this is The Advocates with Richard J. Garfunkel and WJUP 103.9 FM radio in Jupiter, Florida.
March 27th, 2016.
Our show starts at 8 a.m. on Sundays. I've been talking to my guest, author Susan Butler, about her marvelous book. We've been discussing her views on World War II, the partnership of Roosevelt and Stalin, and how the war was prosecuted. We'll be back in a few seconds with our next segment. Welcome back to The Advocates with Richard J. Garfunkel on WJUP 103.9 FM radio in Jupiter, Florida. Sunday mornings at 8 a.m. we start. I've been talking to my guest, author Susan Butler, of the acclaimed book on FDR and Stalin and how their coalition were dominant factors in winning World War II. There was a great deal of correspondence between FDR and Joseph Stalin before their first meeting in Tehran. FDR was not only a great politician, but as a statesman, he was also a pragmatist. How did he view Stalin as not only critical to the war, but critical to his people, Susan?
Well, he knew that Stalin was a dictator, and he knew that he had killed many people. The purges of 1937 and 1938 had impressed all of the world with, I suppose, what you would have to call the savagery of his regime. But he also knew that what he wanted was to go down in history as a great leader of the Russian people. So anything that would help Russia, he knew would help the war, and that everything that he did to help Russia would be appreciated by Stalin. And of course, that was absolutely true. Stalin realized right away that America was the most powerful country in the world, and Roosevelt was extending a hand to him and saying, you know, if you behave yourself and protect your country, you will be rewarded. Russia will have a big say at the peace table. So Stalin was always ready to listen to whatever Roosevelt said, because what Roosevelt was saying to him was, if you pay attention to what you're doing, you will be more powerful at the end of the war than you were at the beginning of the war.
Mm. The Second Front in Europe and the fear of a Soviet collapse were the most critical concerns with the Western Allies. Why was the Second Front so critical, and how did FDR and Churchill respond to Stalin's pleas for help on the continent of Europe? In other words, establishing this Second Front to take the pressure off him.
Well, Roosevelt was all for it right away. Churchill first said that before a second front was instituted, more troops would have to be sent, and the Allies would have to be careful because we didn't want to be defeated. But behind it all, really, was his fear of Stalin. He was so irrationally afraid of Stalin that he thought that when the Allies got onto the continent of Europe, Stalin might attack them.
Huh.
And, of course, that idea never entered Roosevelt's head. But the importance of a second front, of course, was that it would take away the troops that were menacing the Soviet Union and that were at Stalingrad and Leningrad. It would take away troops, because if Russia, if England and America attacked the German troops on the continent, then Hitler would have to pull troops away from the Soviet Union to fight.
Right. Well, of course, the United States wanted to get into the action right away. That's why we developed the invasion with the coordination of the British later in North Africa. Of course, this wasn't enough for Stalin, because this was dealing with almost a peripheral theater of war.
In the first moments, that is what Stalin thought. But then after the invasion was successful, he was very complimentary, and he realized how important actually it had been.
Oh, yeah. There's no question it was. And in the same way, the invasion of Sicily and Italy took pressure off Stalin. Of course, the Germans had to, with the collapse of Italy, which came pretty quickly, and of course, the deposing of Mussolini, they had to bring in tremendous amount of crack troops to stop the fall of their most important ally. You know, as the United States became not only the arsenal of democracy, but the senior partner in the West with regards to strategy, ideas, and manpower, Churchill started to acquiesce to FDR's views at the Quebec Conference on the dismemberment of Germany, the issue of unconditional surrender, and even some of the issues regarding colonialism. How did Stalin view both FDR and Churchill on some of these issues?
Well, he was for a while worried, particularly about whether Roosevelt was going to support any of England's colonial possessions. But Roosevelt was also became quite outspoken about the fact that he thought that that colonialism was not only wrong, that one country should not control another country, but he thought that colonial empires were a destabilizing influence and led to war.
Mm.
As far as unconditional surrender went, for Roosevelt, that was really almost a pragmatic decision, because if you made a nation surrender unconditionally, then there would be no treaties, no problems. He was operating under the memory, basically, of how Wilson had messed up the end of World War I at the Treaty of Versailles, and he didn't want to deal with anybody. Roosevelt wanted to stay in control, and the perfect way to stay in control and teaching the Germans a lesson was to make them surrender unconditionally.
Mm. And, of course, Churchill feared that, saying that it would stiffen their resistance. Of course, Churchill probably was looking for a negotiator. Yeah, go ahead.
The thing is that a reporter at one point asked Roosevelt whether he thought that, didn't Roosevelt think, the reporter asked, that this was stiffening Germany's resistance and prolonging the war, and Roosevelt replied that if it did, that might be a good thing, because it was going to teach the Germans a lesson.
Hmm. A lot of people forget that Roosevelt was really quite anti-German from his days at Baden-Baden with his father decades earlier. He was not a fan of German authoritativism, and was very anti the Kaiser and the sense of the Germans as an aggressive people, and basically Churchill was not of that feeling. Was very unhappy that he twisted his arm at Quebec in getting him to co-sign the Morgenthau Plan for the dismemberment of Germany. But I think you hit the point right on the head about the lost piece of Wilson, that the Roosevelt was in great fears that if this was not finished and the Nazism and fascism was not erased, it would just reemerge after the war, sometime.
It's interesting now, because it seems so incomprehensible to us as in 2016, but both Roosevelt and Stalin were convinced that there was going to be a third world war because Germany was going to bide its time and then try again. They were convinced that Germany was going to attack Russia a third time.
Mm. You know, before we hear a word from our sponsors again, this is The Advocates with Richard J. Garfunkel, WJUP 103.9 FM radio in Jupiter, Florida.
March 27th, 2016.
Our program starts Sunday mornings at 8 a.m. I've been talking to my guest, author Susan Butler, about World War II, the partnership of FDR and Stalin during that incredible war. And after the break, we'll discuss how the Cold War emerged. We'll be back in a few seconds. Welcome back to The Advocates on March 20th with Richard J. Garfunkel, WJUP 103.9 FM in Jupiter, Florida. We broadcast on Sunday mornings starting at 8 a.m. I've been talking to my guest, author Susan Butler, about the winning of the World War II, and we're going to talk a little bit about what happened at the end of it. You know, in the words of Professor Castiglione, who you know quite well, it was Harriman who had worked most tirelessly to distort and undo Roosevelt's vision, who later paid the most poignant testimony to his wartime boss. Harriman later stated FDR was basically right in thinking he could make progress by personal relationships with Stalin. The Russians were utterly convinced that change came as a result of the shift from Roosevelt to Truman. Negative changes, of course. The big three last met at Stalin at Yalta. We all have heard that name in the Crimea, and many critical decisions were made. Susan, how did FDR deal with the reality of the growing strength of the Soviet Union in Eastern Europe, and did he look to create the impression that the Western Allies would not form a monolithic force against the Soviet Union?
Well, as the war was drawing to a close in 1945, and the Russian soldiers who had driven the Nazis out of Eastern Europe and closed the death camps, that were still killing people, and certainly, particularly in Poland. FDR was waiting for Stalin to institute measures that would allow Poland to govern itself, and at Yalta, Roosevelt got Stalin. Roosevelt and Churchill also signed on. At Yalta, Stalin signed two really important documents. One was the document on liberated Europe, and the other one was the one on Poland. And both of them, it was written, it's so amazing now and even then, that Stalin signed these documents where he agreed that that there would be free and unfettered elections throughout Eastern Europe, and particularly in Poland. Now, people say that Roosevelt gave away Eastern Europe, but considering that the Soviet army was in those countries because they had just liberated them and they had just fought the Germans, and then Stalin signed these documents promising free and unfettered elections and to respect the institutions of the Polish government. I've never understood how anybody could think that anybody could even possibly think that Roosevelt gave away Eastern Europe.
Right. FDR envisioned a big four comprised the United States, Soviet Union, Great Britain, and the emerging China, which would force it to keep the peace, work for decolonialization, build understanding between competing economic and social systems. He understood the dynamic nationalism and clearly that the Soviet Union was, as you said, and we know, control of Eastern Europe, and they would not easily give up this hard-earned buffer. He certainly didn't believe it was in America's interest to fight a third world war over Poland's sovereignty. I think he understood that. With that in mind, after the death of FDR in April 45, what happened to the peace? And was Anthony Eden, who was foreign secretary in those days of Britain, when he said that had Roosevelt lived and retained his health, he would have never permitted the present situation develop. His death, therefore, was a calamity of immeasurable proportions. How did it fall apart, you know, this kind of entente cordiale that we had with the Soviet Union?
Well, I think that basically what happened was the atom bomb. That if Roosevelt had lived, he was, I'm quite convinced, and he had said it a month before he died, that he was going to, that he thought it was time to share knowledge of the atom bomb with the Soviet Union. And I think it would have made an incredible difference, because if we hadn't had an arms race, I think the world would be a different place.
Yeah.
And I think that actually Harry Hopkins, after Roosevelt died, Harry Hopkins had gone to Moscow and had a series of long talks with Stalin, because after Roosevelt's death, Stalin started to pull back and change his mind about a number of policies, and Harry Hopkins went to him and said, "Look, you can't change your mind about these things. If you do, you are going to lose the United States as an ally." Well, I don't think people realize how crucial this was to Stalin's thinking, nor do I think that people realize how incredibly down and desperate Russia was at the end of World War II. They had lost 27 million people. 7 million German soldiers had killed 27 million Russians.
Mm.
15% of the Russian population was dead.
Right. Well,
most of their thousands of their villages were destroyed. The country was in desperate straits.
Right.
And then we refused to share the knowledge of the bomb with the Soviet Union. And I do think that if Roosevelt had lived, I think Anthony Eden was perfectly right.
Mm.
It was a calamity.
Yeah. Well, also, there's a quote by Harriman, who unfortunately later felt he had been seduced by his own prejudice about Russia, and he said if Roosevelt had lived with full vigor, it's very hard to say what could have happened. Roosevelt could lead the world, in a sense that the trust Truman wasn't prepared. It wasn't his fault particularly, but Roosevelt was that kind of world statesman who could handle it. Very few people could handle it like he could. I think in your book, your marvelous book, it has to be read by people to understand this whole relationship in totality. Again, I want to thank you, Susan, for a great show and a most cogent view on what happened in those critical years before, during World War II, and how we were able to forge this relationship that really almost died with Roosevelt. And thank you for coming on, okay?
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. It's always a pleasure to have, terrific guests who really understand what, you know, is going on in this world. I just want to mention before we close that your book is coming out in paperback. I assume it can be found almost anywhere. Is that true?
Absolutely.
Okay. Again, I suggest people read Roosevelt and Stalin and the partnership that won the war. If you want to hear this broadcast or any of the other archived advocates broadcasts, you can access them on my website, www.theadvocatesradio.com, where all the information of my guests is always posted.
Next week, I'll be hosting author James Bradley of Flags of Our Fathers fame, and we'll be talking about China and the mistakes of our diplomacy that led to conflicts in the second half of the 20th century. Thanks. See you next week.
Thank you again, Susan Butler. Stay well. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.